This is a special bonus series of Judaism Unbound, Bovo Buch, a Yiddish Don Quixote. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Dan Liebenson.
And I'm Lex Rothberg.
And today we are kicking off a four-episode mini-series, a bonus series of Judaism Unbound. We've never done that before, in collaboration with Theater Dybbuk. Theater Dybbuk is a theater company based in Los Angeles, which creates provocative performances and innovative educational encounters that explore Jewish thought to illuminate universal human experience. As you can imagine, because of the pandemic, theater companies are not able to do their theater work in the way that they usually might. So we're really excited to collaborate with Theater Dybbuk on what is basically a combination of theater analysis, theater history, learning about theater, and also experiencing some of the performance of theater all in your ears. Today, we're going to be speaking with Aaron Henney, the artistic director of Theater Dybbuk, and Irit Jaffe Berg, a professor of theater, about a Yiddish play called Bovo Buch that is set in the Middle Ages, and it's basically a story of a Yiddish-speaking knight and his adventures. It's a story that Theater Dybbuk probably would have developed into a more usual sort of play that would have taken place in the unusual but fantastic and kind of regular way that Theater Dybbuk as a theater company might have put on a piece of theater, but actually something about the idea of a Yiddish knight in shining armor makes sense to not do in the usual way. And so we're excited to be able to do it here on this podcast. So if you're intrigued by today's conversation that we're going to have about Bovo Buch, the next episodes in the series are going to be coming in rapid succession over the next 3 days. Bovo Buch was written in Yiddish in the 16th century. It's an adaptation of a popular Italian chivalric romance called Bovo d'Antona. Not sure if I pronounced that right in the original Italian, but the book was extremely popular among Jewish communities at the time. And it's an example of the cultural convergence that occurs when a narrative is adapted into a new context. The author of Bovo Buch was named Ilya Levita, and we're excited to talk about the original play and Theater Dybbuk's adaptation of it today with our two guests. Let me give them a little bit more introduction. Aaron Henney is the artistic director of Theater Dybbuk. Aaron Henney was previously a guest on Judaism Unbound, episode 156. In addition to being the artistic director of Theater Dybbuk, he is a playwright, an educator, and he teaches storytelling workshops throughout the country, including designing and facilitating workshops for organizations like Lucasfilm, Pixar, and DreamWorks. He's also won a long list of fellowships, but I'm not going to name all of them right now. And our second guest is Irit Jaffe Berg. She is a professor of theater at the Department of Theater, Film, and Digital Production at the University of California at Riverside. Her research focuses on the Commedia dell'arte and performances by Jews and other minority groups in early modern Italy. She's the author of two books, Commedia dell'arte and the Mediterranean, Charting Journeys and Mapping Others, and The Multilingual Art of Commedia dell'arte. She is currently completing a book on the Jewish contribution to 16th and 17th century theater in northern Italy. She has also won many fellowships and grants. So we're really excited to launch this four-episode series today in collaboration with Theater Dybbuk, exploring Bovo Buch and experiencing some of it in performance. So Aaron Henney, Irit Jaffe Berg, welcome to Judaism Unbound. It's so great to have you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So I thought that we could start by, we're doing this interesting collaboration. I think, you know, our listeners, I want to get them in real quick and understand why, because this is a really fascinating project. So could we start a little bit, Aaron, just tell us about Bovo Buch and what it is, a little bit of the story, like get us going here.
Bovo Buch is a 16th century chivalric romance written in Yiddish. Chivalric romance is not traditionally a Jewish or Yiddish form. It's often associated with kind of Christian dominant cultures. It's tales of knights and queens and peasants and princesses, etc. And what makes this work so unique is that this author, Ilya Levita, basically took a source text and translated / adapted it into Yiddish. And the reason I say translated / adapted is because while it borrows elements from an original, which Irit can tell you more about, it definitely also takes its own trajectory at the same time and is written in a way that is really meant to serve the Jewish community of Europe at the moment it was being written and published.
And when was that? When was it actually written?
It was composed around 1507, but it was published in 1541. And it was composed while the author Elia Levita was living in northern Italy, but it was published actually in Isny, which is in Germany.
And what's really interesting is, given the time period, is to recognize, first of all, how shockingly, in some ways, modern it hits our ears, in that there's moments of great sexuality, there's ribald humor, there's gruesome descriptions of things in ways that I think we don't often associate with the romances of that period, even if they actually were occurring. And so this is to say, that's what makes the work exciting, is that it's an adventure story that goes through many lands, that has many characters, and that also, because the author claims that it was written for a female readership to read on Shabbat, basically, it also gives, in some ways, more in-depth exploration to the female figure's psychology than it does to the male figure's psychology, which is kind of fascinating. So that's just a little glimpse of what the work is.
I think that sort of spells it out perfectly. It's taken from a source text, Bevis of Hampton, which is making its way throughout the English lands. And then that is transferred over to an Italian version. And then that becomes the inspiration for a translation. You know, it's being circulated among Christian readers. It's being circulated among people who are conversant in the English vernaculars as well as the Italian vernaculars. And now it's become popularized among members of the Jewish community that are living in northern Italy. And they want, it seemed like, they want their own version and their own vernacular, which interestingly is not Hebrew at the time for them, because as Aaron said, it's meant for women. It's supposed to be, you know, for women to do something in Shabbos, he tells us, Elia Levita, in his introduction. And so he writes it in Yiddish, which would have been very accessible to, you know, women readers, women Jewish readers, but also men in the Jewish community at the time, and certainly among the Ashkenazi communities that are living in northern Italy. So yes, this is a local version, a community version of a popular story that's going around, and the chivalric romances are very popular dating back to the Middle Ages, but they're certainly still popular in the early modern period.
When we did a series on Yiddish a few months ago, we talked to Naomi Seidman, and she talked about how a lot of books were portrayed as if they were for women, but really because men would be not really, you know, thought of very highly to read a chivalric romance. You're supposed to be reading the Talmud. But if you said that it was for women, you could publish it, and then the men would have access to it and would read it, I guess, like we read a comic book in synagogue, you know, under the other book.
Right. Yeah, I think it's enticing, and I could see that it would be appealing both to men and women as well.
So I want to say something directly right now for anybody listening. This story is bonkers. Like, it is disorienting, and I mean that only in a positive way, but like genuinely, it's like strange to read because of what you said before about how it's translated and adapted. It's clearly like taking a story that's not quite a Jewishly originated thing, and it's doing its best to sort of like apply these concepts that were designed for and by a different group onto itself. And then they add their own layers and they put in that, like, this is a wild story. And it's like different from anything I've ever read before. It's just weird. I'm curious, because you mentioned that this original story was translated and adapted. In a sense, I hear translated as implying that, like, it was translated, the words were translated, but it was also like the context was translated. That's where the adapted comes in. I'm curious to pivot from that, because it's originally an adaptation, a translation, to what you're doing with it now. Because in a sense, you're taking this translation adaptation of a Christian or at least European kind of modality into a European Jewish modality. Now you're taking that and, oh, it's 2020 and we're Theater Dybbuk. And we're going to do that in the United States, or at least digitally, which I don't even know if anything's in the United States anymore, if it's digital. But like, here we are. So what does that mean? Why are you doing this? Like, why is it worthwhile to take this on? And I guess this is a little of a leading question, because I think the answer is yes. But is there a way in which your effort today to map this existing story onto our society actually mirrors the original effort to map the European story onto this, like, sort of specifically Jewish European story.
Part of the reason why Theodor Dybbuk is taking on this experience of exploring Bova Buch is because our project as a company is to unpack Jewish history, to open our minds to the complex nature of existence and of cultural exchange and of questions of dominance and power and marginalization. And Bova Buch, for all its wildness and ridiculousness, is actually a great container for these questions of complexity within a society. And so I'll speak a little bit more about that, which is, one, we often think about Jewish communities in places such as Northern Italy as quite literally ghettoized, right? Often living in ghettos, as being marginalized, isolated, hitting against the dominant culture and feeling crushed by it. Those are sometimes the assumptions that go with our understanding of that moment in history. And so by presenting a work that actually says, wait, this community, one of its most popular pieces of literature, actually borrowed from the dominant culture and recontextualized it, I think is a perfect portrait of the way in which societies work. And that when even when a group is marginalized, it can't help but be in conversation, for better and worse, with the culture in which it resides. And so I'm really excited about the way in which this work gets us thinking about, even without us necessarily stating it overtly, gets us thinking about our own world. And when are we appropriating from the dominant culture in a way? And that word appropriation has some very negative connotations in some areas, but I actually want to take the word and say appropriation as an act of borrowing and making one's own, right? That what is it to be a marginalized group and borrow and then make one's own? There is something oddly aspirational in that, right? To say that in spite of the fact that we are a marginalized group with very little power in this society, we can have an imagination of us as royalty, as adventurers going through the world. What does that do for a people to be able to take ownership over the works that don't belong to them and say, these are mine too? I live in this society and these are mine as well. And I'm going to put Yiddish words in the mouths of knights. What does that do to my own feeling of power and belonging? Now, one might also be able to argue the other side, that it's extremely problematic too, right? Because obviously they don't actually have ownership over it and they can't achieve that kind of power. And so that kind of aspiration allows one to engage in fantasy without actually being able to transcend one's position. So I understand the problematic nature of it as well. But I would say this is why explore it. Why now? Because we are richer as people if we can hold this kind of complexity. And if it can make us uncomfortable, if it can make us question our position in society and our relationship to both the dominant and the marginalized.
I'm wondering, Aaron, if you could talk a little bit about this particular project of what's coming up over the next few weeks, and how does that connect to what Theodor Dybbuk does and COVID? Meaning, like, I'm asking, what would you have done with this story had COVID not been around? What are you doing instead? What do you imagine doing in the future? And I think more broadly, there's a question in there about how does the situation that we're in right now connect to the mission and what a theater company does, and in particular, a theater company like Theodor Dybbuk, which, you know, I think as I'm thinking this through, it's like your mission of all this exploration and translation and you know, reimagination, that there's actually another layer added onto that through COVID. I mean, we can see it as an obvious problem for a theater company, because how are we going to get people together to see our theater? Or you can see it as, well, this is the whole point of our particular theater company, is that we explore tough questions like that. So I'm wondering where that took you all.
So there are two to three kind of reasons behind engaging with this in this moment. One is obviously just practical, right? We are a live theatrical organization that can't currently do live in-person work, and thinking about then how do we engage with people. And I will say that in a way, doing something that seems further away brings us closer. And what I mean by that is a number of people said, well, why don't you do Zoom plays and that kind of thing? And I have resistance to that because screens are a form in and of themselves, dealing with screens. And that theater for me is a place where the participant is asked to create half the fiction. When we watch things on screens, we sort of imprint that we are watching something that looks, feels, smells like reality, as of where when we go to the theater, we automatically accept that we have to help create the reality. So in a funny way, doing things on Zoom creates new problems because we're accustomed to watching screens and engaging in the way we do in TV and film, as of where doing an audio work actually asks the same thing of listeners as we ask of audience members in the theater. You are creating this with me. You only have certain things to engage with, and you have to create the rest of it in your mind's eye. So one is that's the reason why this current pivot to audio work, to podcasting, is because in some ways it brings us closer to our way of working rather than further away. I will also say on a practical level, so too, Irit said to me, I've been studying this really interesting text for a long time. I've become kind of obsessed with it. And it feels like it's something that maybe Theater Dybbuk would be interested in. And I really trust Irit because our show last year, which it was called Hell Prepared and explored a ritual exorcist of Northern Italy, Irit brought me the source text for that. So I was like, I trust you. You know what works for us and what we're interested in. And so Irit brought this to me and I thought, what a perfect text to begin this exploration of audio work, because especially once I learned that how people read it was in groups together and they would listen together. So we're creating something that in some ways speaks to that original way that the text operated. I think three, at the end of the day, Theater Dybbuk's team kind of pushed me on this. You know, I'm an artist who said, we're a theater company. We do theater. If we can't be doing theater, should we be doing anything, right? That was at the beginning of the pandemic. Things, you know, things evolve. And I had team members who said, yes, Aaron, but we are a company that is about causing deep thought in the world and asking people to ask hard questions about themselves, their community, and society around them. And if that's really why we exist, then how do we take the skills we have and still help to cause that outcome? We still needed to fulfill our mission, which theater is the vessel through which we reach that mission. Traditionally. And so that's kind of the why of all of it in this moment.
I'll just say that I enjoy chivalric romances. I enjoy romances. I guess I am the ideal reader that La Vita was writing for, that, you know, woman to be reading on Shabbos or whenever. I was looking for a way to come back to this. And when COVID hit, and we were all in a stay-at-home mode, and it was very isolated and insular, it struck me, I kept remembering a performance that I'd seen by the British performer Simon McBurney of a play called The Encounter. And in that performance, the audience was invited to put on headsets in a public auditorium. And we were invited to see a performer on stage doing essentially a one-man show, but also to hear him very intimately because he was literally in our ears. And I thought, wow, that experience was so powerful. And during this period of COVID, that's a little bit of what we're experiencing, right? We're isolated from one another. We're viewing each other in these little boxes, squares on Zoom or whatever. But we're also invited into people's interiors, right? You see my living room, you see my bedroom, you see my kitchen, you see my kids, you see my dogs. So there's something very intimate and also very distant in this period. But reading is like that, and public reading especially is like that. And so this text was so much of our time as well. It invited being explored. And I was so delighted when Aaron and I, in dialogue together, thought, well, yeah, it's perfect for a podcast. It's perfect for a podcast series that, again, both enters people's homes in an intimate way, but also invites us to share communally.
We're doing a fun back and forth between like the text of Vova Buch and its origins and like us today. And I want to continue disorienting everyone and like go back into Vova Buch for a second. I read it, and so I sent Dan a message. I sent Dan a bunch of messages as I was finishing because it was just so bonkers. But I sent him a message that said, Dan, this is one big hashtag representation matters text. And what I mean by that is, so there's all this important really important discourse today about culture, about pop culture, and how there isn't enough women's representation, but how we've done a very poor job with minority representation, with black representation, with trans representation. And there's a lot of forward motion finally happening to at least talk about that and start to address it. And what this text did for me is it helped me realize, sometimes I think as a Jew, even me who like tries to study Jewish history, like I think there are certain issues that are like sort of my time and like didn't really manifest in the same way in the past. But I look at this text where they're trying to map this popular genre, chivalric romance, onto their Jewish selves. They want to see, like, I can picture a 10-year-old hearing this for the first time and being so excited that there's a Jewish version of this story that they've heard, in the same way that I was a 6-year-old and so excited that there's a Rugrats Hanukkah or Rugrats Passover episode and not just the 47 Christmas episodes. And the thing people don't talk about with Adam Sandler's Hanukkah song, which was so important, is the preface he says before the actual words start is, hey, there's a bunch of Christmas songs out there, but you know, the little Jewish kids don't have too many Hanukkah songs. And then he starts, put on your yarmulke, here comes Hanukkah, whatever. And just to layer onto this, how this is so relatable in our time, literally, like, I imagine the people who put together the movie An American Tale, you know, the animated picture featuring an immigrant mouse. And I imagine that that could have theoretically started as, you know, there's kind of a big deal mouse in animated Hollywood, Mickey Mouse. What if we had a Jewish one? Like, maybe Fievel Mouskowitz. We'll go with that name. And like, then the rest of the story flows from there. And everybody should go watch An American Tale. But like, this, what I felt from this is like a real resonance that like, oh, it's not just that like TV was invented and all of a sudden the idea of being represented in the public eye was a new issue. Like, this has existed 500 years ago. It existed before that. So I guess just to take us back into this text, like, can you add some specifics to like how that even happens here? Like, what are they doing with the Yiddishisms? How, and maybe this is for Irit, since I know you're like, you know, the origin text as well. Like, what are they doing here? What are the subtle and less subtle ways that they're taking on that representation matters kind of task?
Well, I think when they're using Yiddish, it's already infusing irony into the text. So when you have a text about a knight and he's going out on a journey and he's going to face different dragons and he's going to fight different soldiers, that's very straight text. But then when you infuse it with oi, and then, you know, a lot of, and he hit them on their tuchis, you know, to a Jewish ear, right, that lands with irony. Because, you know, tuchis and the night, it doesn't really go together. Not really. Of course they have tuchises, but you don't think about that in those terms, in those veiled ways. So I think the text already is layered with a veneer of irony. And that's really important to the whole experience of being, of representing others and representing yourself within a story that doesn't usually make room for yourself. Similarly, in the story, we have very negative representations of so-called heathens who are in the text. They're always referring to Muslims, right? And this speaks to a very troubled relationship between religions as having negative views towards one another. Well, this is a little surprising in the early modern period because for Jews, especially Jews residing in northern Italy, Islam and Muslim lands were not necessarily negative in their experiencing. I mean, many Levantine Jews who are living in Italy and many Sephardic Jews coming from the Iberian Peninsula and also coming from Portugal and Spain, you know, they had a very positive experience with encounters with the Muslim religion, with the Muslim culture. And of course, there's the Ottoman Empire, which at the time was welcoming, relatively welcoming of Jews. They had to live there as others, Dimi they were called, but still welcoming. It may be surprising to find in this text such negative views of Islam and of heathens and Muslims, and even calling one of the Muslim characters Lucifer. I mean, very negative. And I think there you see a tension between the actual lived, experienced Jewish authentic experience and the desire to take on sort of the mantle of the Christian telling of the tale. And in the Christian songs, in the Christian tales, the Muslims are a real opponent. But that wouldn't have necessarily been internalized by the Jewish communities, especially by the Sephardic communities or the Levantine communities. And it would have been very remote for the Ashkenazi communities, the Tedeschi, the German Jews who are living and who actually were speaking the Yiddish, right? So it was it's really a case in which you could see that the Jewish telling of the representation of the Muslim other is at this point almost artificially gesturing, nodding towards the Christian telling. So yeah, I think that this play is full of grappling and wrestling with questions of representation of women as others, of others in general, of Muslims, and of Christians. And the Christians are represented here in a very, their Christianity is not engaged with. It's kind of like, oh, we don't really speak about that. But you know, the non-Jewish, they use the term goy, but they also use the term chitzoni, right? Outsider, which is a very different way of saying non-Jew.
What's also interesting about representation and these questions connected to representation are the way in which items in popular culture, which is what this is, this was existing in the popular culture of these Jewish communities, both upend and support the dominant, right? That what's fascinating about this is it upends it by making this our story. They are speaking Yiddish words. There is therefore seemingly representation of this aspirational position in society. They are also owning, therefore, the prejudices that the dominant culture may also have against other peoples. There is also an interiority to the female figures that doesn't exist for the male figures. So therefore, you also in some ways have greater, more meaningful female representation in the piece than you do male. So on the one hand, what an upending of society and the dominant. We are here. This is our story. On the other hand, is it really? It's cosmetically Jewish, but not deeply so. All of the positions of the characters are positions we would often identify with Christian figures. The ways in which they walk through the world, other than occasionally, you know, having a bris or using Yiddish, are aligned with the culture that surrounds them. Even, as Zarit said, even their relationship to Islam and to Muslims is really about taking on the Christian relationship to Islam or Muslims. So I think about this, obviously, in our modern world. Representation matters, and it's also problematic when it is fully aligned with or taking on what society says matters. And I think that's also why Bova Book is fascinating, because it's both at once, and we can't tell one story about it. And if we try to tell one story about it, we actually strip away its complexity and therefore strip away our own.
I have one sort of historical question before we just move towards what's going to come up in the rest of this amazing project and series. I'm thinking about how important or how unique Bova Buch is in the story of Yiddish literature. As you were talking earlier, I was thinking about this question of representation. Like, my favorite literature, at least as a kid, was science fiction. And I remember the one book that I found that was a Jewish science fiction book. And I actually eventually reacquired it from eBay or Amazon or whatever, because I just treasured the idea that there was this Jewish science fiction book. And there are a few others, but basically there aren't very many. And it was actually, then I sat down to read it, and it was actually a pretty bad book. And I'm kind of embarrassed that I own it, you know, but it has a lot of importance to me personally as a memory and that representation aspect. And I'm curious about Bova Buch within the world of Yiddish literature in its genre. Is there others? You know, is that a phenomenon, or is, in a sense, this is one of the only ones? And I'm particularly thinking about it because of what I learned from, I believe, originally the Yiddishist Michael Wex, who talks about that we think that the term Bova Maisa comes from the idea of Bova in Yiddish, which is a grandmother, and so it's a grandmother tale. And so some tall tale, some crazy convoluted tale, that's a grandmother tale. But actually, it's a Bova Maisa in its original, and it comes from this book, Bova Buch, and that a crazy convoluted tale is therefore a Bova Maisa. And sure, now it's also a Bova Maisa grandmother tale because the word kind of turned into that. And so, you know, that's how language works. But in its origin, and so again, I wonder, you know, where was this book in Yiddish literature? Like, how important was it? And was there others? And, you know, where does it sit? What do we understand? What should we understand now that we kind of are at the end of this series, are going to have a real deep familiarity with this book.
I think this, Levita himself wrote another book that is similar, let's say, at Paris Une Vienne. So there was, let's say, at least one or a possibility of another type of book like this. But I think the Beauvaubourg does really stand out. And it's really important also, not only for its own uniqueness, but for its importance as being one of the first books that get published in Yiddish and then has 30 republications over subsequent centuries. I mean, it has this enduring legacy, I think partially because it is so powerful as a fantastical journey into a genre that doesn't usually get a stage in Yiddish. I mean, you have a lot of Minhagim book, you've got a lot of customs books and books that relate to different sayings and different teachings. But this one is a total fantasy, right? So I think it's absolutely unique in that sense. And I'll just say that at the same time, you've got Jewish communities in Northern Italy that are exploring with different stories. But when they're doing so, and I'm thinking about communities like in the town of Mantua in southern Lombardy, not too far from Venice, where this is being conceived, that are dabbling in theater, for example, and creating theater. But when they're doing that and when they're writing their stories, I think their stories have a gravity and a seriousness, even when they're comedies. And they deal with issues of Judaic law in terms of marriage. And, you know, they deal with things in a very heavy and thoughtful way that I think, as I said, there's so much irony here. That's not the case with Bovo. There is a real lightness and flair and permission to be excessive.
Let's dive into what's going to be happening. Aaron Eri, can you talk us through what these bonus episodes are going to be? How are we going to be experiencing Beauvaubourg so that folks listening know what they're in store for without too many spoilers, but just, you know, a little overview?
We'll be taking listeners on a 3-episode journey. In episode 1, the idea is that you'll be introduced to Beauvaubourg even in more complete detail than we've covered here. And that introduction will take two forms. One is an interview with Irit, sharing some of the history, the cultural context, how Beauvaubourg works, as well as actors reading selections from the book. So in between bits of the interview, you will actually hear portions of the book read in English translation by Jerry C. Smith. And one is, I want to say what's really fun about this is because Beauvaubourg reached so far and wide, we opted as a company that rather than doing the standard audiobook thing where you have one performer reading, kind of taking on all the characters, we actually have a variety of actors so that each episode has different actors reading parts of the book so that you get this sense of the large ways in which it impacted the communities. That's episode 1. Episode 2, I think episode 2 might be the most fun. We get into sexuality and gender in the piece. And I'll just say, spoiler alert, there's some pretty ribald experiences in the book around sexuality. And so you will hear actors read some selections of that. And then again, Irit and I will be in discussion about the way in which gender and sexuality work in the piece, especially because, as we said, Levita claimed this to be a book that was meant for women to read. And so we talk about how that is revealed in the descriptions inside the book and the ways in which characters are portrayed. In the 3rd episode, we really think about the impact the book had, the various communities it reached, the way in which it spread throughout Europe. And we also talk about some of the difficulties in it, such as the way in which it speaks about Islam and Muslims and the racialization of the people associated with that faith tradition. And so we get into that. And again, you hear actors reading the selections. So the trajectory really goes from cultural context, what is the book, to sexuality and gender, to the larger implications, all interwoven with hearing bits and pieces of the text. It's pretty exciting and fun and informative. The provocation inside this 3-episode series, I think, is that often when we speak about Jewish text and studying Jewish history. Obviously, in academic circles and some scholarly circles, there can be real interest in these hidden texts or not so hidden that are actually quite known in certain ways. I think often in our popular imagination, we stick to the biggies, right? The Torah, the Talmud, and we think that these tell the story of our people. And I think the provocation inside this is to say, here is a piece of popular literature that's fun, ridiculous, that actually, other than some Yiddish references and such, seems not to be overtly Jewish in many ways. And yet, it reveals so much about our history and the cultures in which we operated and how we navigated those cultural waters. And I think we would be richer as a community and as communities if we sort of widened our view to ask, what are the entry points that might allow us to see how we've operated throughout history and how does that speak to who we are today? The Bovo Buch, which again feels like not a sacred text because it isn't, it's a piece of popular literature, tells us so much if we get curious about it, of who we are and where we've been and therefore where we might be headed. I hope that it encourages people to look for other texts and other sources that seem outside of being maybe worthy of study to them, but that actually can reveal a lot.
Absolutely. Thank you both so much for joining us for this conversation. We are really excited, both Dan and I, to hear the follow-ups. And just to everybody, read this story. It's wild. Listen to the excerpts and the commentary. You want it in your life. I can't express this enough. So thanks, Aaron. Thanks, Iri, for joining us. It's been a pleasure having you on.
Thank you very much.
And thank you to all of you out there listening. We hope you've enjoyed this episode. I'm not going to say too much more. Listen to these follow-ups. They're going to be amazing. And with that, this has been Judaism Unbound.